Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money video audio commentary, and this is Owen Tracy recording at 1:44. That is Pacific Standard Time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term video for the various different asset classes. And today it's of course the last recording for the year, and it has been quite a year in terms of the news flow, and I think everyone knows what the news is, so I thought that I would concentrate more on exactly what we're seeing in the technology sector. I think in the last few audios, I think I've sort of largely neglected and rather than highlight evidence to the fact that technological innovation is accelerating, I've just been taking it for granted in terms of what I've been displaying on the videos. So I thought I would start off today, rather than leaving it as a footnote, and start off with technological innovation as something that is front and center. It really does matter a great deal to the bullish hypothesis overall. And it is a bullish environment. That is something that is largely undeniable, considering that we have been, the market has been rallying since early 2009, and a number of other markets have been rallying since late 2008. We're approaching the ninth year of this very impressive bull market. At this stage, it must be hard for anyone to conclude that this is a cyclical bull market. I think we have plenty of evidence at this stage that it is a secular bull market. It is, of course, being driven by a number of key themes, and chief among those is technological innovation. And of course, there are others. The fact that governance is improving in the emerging markets, and that is unleashing the productive capacity of literally billions of people, that we are getting the introduction of huge numbers of people that are being lifted out of abject poverty into some approximation of the middle classes, and can now be perhaps more correctly described as consumers than any other particular acronym. That we are also seeing we have been in a period of time where there has been a massive amount of monetary stimulus, and that we could potentially be moving into a period of fiscal stimulus. In addition to that, it isn't just that technology is accelerating, innovation is accelerating, but that the availability of that technology is becoming progressively more available. And if we go back and we think about previous bull markets, that we've had massive bull markets previously, but they were not on a global basis. They were largely limited to the evolution of individual economies and not necessarily in a synchronous order. But certainly China's emergence in the last decade has had a massive effect on was one of the big contributing factors to the commodity boom. Japan really breaking into the world scene as a major corporate leader and as a major manufacturing center drove a massive bull market there. And obviously the technology boom that we had in the 1990s was the animating factor around which you had the culmination of a secular bull market on Wall Street. But what we are perhaps now engaging in is a secular bull market which could potentially culminate, and potentially in 20 years from now could culminate in a global bull market, where it is the realization of the dreams of improving standards of living for billions of people that could drive a very large bull market. And it is being driven by the advance of technology, and most particularly there are two sectors that can really generate productive capacity. One is energy, and two is healthcare. And the way that I tend to think of this is to differentiate and between discretionary spending and necessary spending. One of the reasons that people have been saying that we haven't had the massive bump in productivity growth as a result of the internet recently, because a lot of the innovation has come in the form of Facebook and social media, and the disintermediation overall of the internet happened nearly a decade ago, and that we're just seeing further iterations of that. Now, that is, when we look at what has happened, that retailing has been largely revolutionized, that the record store is gone, the bookstore is gone, but in many respects, that is discretionary spending. When we talk about energy and healthcare, it's necessary spending. If you want transport or heating, if you want air conditioning, you need energy. There is no discretion whatsoever that we absolutely need energy. It is the bedrock on which our economy is based. And this chart that I'm starting out with is the average silicon solar cell module spot price. And this is an accelerating decline. That in 2010 it was pretty close to $2, and now it's a 36 cents. That is an incredible decline. It is, of course, terrible news for the solar cell manufacturing sector, but it is incredibly good news for consumers, that the price of installing solar cells is on an exponential downtrend. And that's incredible. That isn't something that we have had. And it is, in fact, it accelerated lower this year. Almost, although not quite, but almost halving this year. And when we look at this, there is obviously a natural termination that it is unlikely to go to zero, and a large number of these companies are in financial distress, but they are predicting that they can get it into the 20s by the end of next year. And a move from 36 cents to 28 or 29 cents is a massive percentage decline. And what it really suggests is that we are already seeing a lot of solar cells being installed, but in future it isn't that the reason that you won't have more installed certainly won't be because of price. It is that we are going to be thinking more in terms of new buildings, and that it will simply be a no-brainer to have solar cells on those buildings. That the new housing stock that is produced within the next decade will probably go directly for solar cells. There is a clear reason to do that. That you may invest a little bit more in building your house and then never have to pay for heating it again. So, when we think about it in those terms, there is a revolution going on in the energy sector, and it is ongoing, and it is largely because Moore's Law has been a dominant factor in chip production for over 40 years, is now being applied increasingly to the energy sector. That energy needn't necessarily be tied to extraction, that it could be tied to a manufacturing process. And that is what we're seeing with this chart, that solar cells are getting progressively cheaper. And that is profound. That means that when we think about what is happening with the oil market over the very long term, it is likely to be a market that is in overall decline. But that is a long-term prognosis. In the short term, there is potential for higher prices, and in the medium term, we could be in a very long range. If we look at the very long-term chart, and this is a monthly chart, so it and I didn't pull it up. One second. This is a very long-term chart, and it only updates through the end of November. It'll update again on the 1st of January. But what we are presented with, if we go really a long time back, let's go back to 1960, then we are presented with this environment where prices do nothing for a long time and then enter a big bull market. And after the bull market peak in the early 1980s, prices ranged for over 20 years. They never went back down to the price that prevailed before the bull market, but they never really sustained a substantial move above the previous peak. And that was despite the fact that we had wars, recessions, bull markets in between. And right now, we have finished a major bull market. We had an almost decade-long bull market in oil prices. They sustained a high above $100 for a pretty lengthy period of time and then collapsed. We have had two major collapses in the last decade, and we are now rallying from the lower side. Perhaps 140 is a reach, but it isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that due to geopolitical tensions, that $100 is not beyond the reach of oil prices during times of severe geopolitical stress, but that by and large we can anticipate that the upper side of the what could be a volatile range is probably quite a bit below $100. We know that there is substantial hedging at these levels. And part of the reason that we know that is because we can look at the futures curve, and the futures curve is very flat. Between March 2017 and December 2018, there is just over a dollar in price difference. And this is for a commodity that moves a dollar in value with surprising regularity. So, and on top of that, there is quite a sharp contango. So there is no shortage of supply at the present moment. There's no pressure under traders. There is certainly some kind of desire, at least among producers, to hedge their exposure, that they can make money at this level, so that is what they are doing. They're going to ensure that they can make money between now and perhaps even the end of 2018. And if they're willing to hedge at these levels, it means that they're economic at these levels and that they can spend some money to increase production above this price level. So we are potentially towards the upper side of a range. The question, of course, is going to be about economic growth. If economic growth can pick up, then the supply side of the equation will pick up, and then they will have to invest additional money to meet that additional demand. That is perhaps why we have a bullish orientation to the price environment at right now, not least because OPEC, of course, has cut their production. And $60 is a psychological level. But we will not have an indication that oil prices have hit a short-term peak until we see them a clear downward dynamic. And we know what those clear downward dynamics look like because we've seen them at previous peaks, and we haven't had any just yet. And very short term, there is a progression of higher reaction lows that would really need to be broken to really question that we aren't going to see somewhat higher prices in the short term. But when we think about oil over the long term, then we really do have to remember that solar cell chart, because solar is something that is going to become progressively ubiquitous, and it is going to be further enabled by battery technology. And the fact that Tesla was able to agree to supply Los Angeles with an 80-megawatt battery and to have it delivered within 3 months to really help solve the city's problem following the gas leak that knocked out a lot of the city's gas supply for this winter, is a testament to the fact that technology is improving rapidly and that the capacity to deliver these kinds of solutions is now possible. That is something that was not possible 5 years ago, that regardless of how much you would want a battery, there was no factory in existence that could deliver something like that within 3 months, and yet it has been done. So, if you can twin a battery solution or a storage solution more generally with the with a solar cell, then you have a solution to the base load problem. And that does then mean that future power stations can be in the right areas. They're either going to be wind, in other areas they're going to be solar, but the number of areas in which there isn't going to be some form of renewable energy that is going to be long-lasting and relatively cheap is going to be pretty limited. So that is something that is going to weigh on fossil fuels. It's going to weigh on the oil market, because if batteries are improving, and batteries are improving, then the ability to have electric cars is going to become progressively cheaper. Battery technology is not improving at the same rate that we're seeing in solar cells. That is certainly the case. It's taking about 5 years overall for battery technology, or the energy density of batteries, to double. But that 5 year window is quite a bit faster than it would have been 10 years ago. So there is a lot of money flowing into the battery sector right now, and certainly Tesla is more of a battery company than just about anything else, despite the fact that it's manufacturing cars and that its CEO is one of the best marketers in the world and talking about visiting Mars. The reality is that the company is a battery company, and the synergies through the bailout of Solar City are quite obvious. That a battery company that can also produce solar cells is producing a unified solution, because the reality, of course, is that the sun does not it does not shine at night, and there is obviously substantial demand for energy when the sun goes down. So that, of course, is something that can be solved with batteries. And it means that we are going to have an environment where there is going to be a substantial demand growth for energy. And I think that is something that many people tend to forget, is that the Jevons paradox, which has been really a feature of the commodity complex for a very long time indeed, and we are talking centuries. And it is very simple, that technological innovation enables more of something to be produced, and in this case, it's electricity. That drives down the price. And of course, what that then does, when you've got a low price and abundant supply, people come up with new ways to use it. And eventually, that will soak up the available supply, and then you will get a supply inelasticity meets rising demand bull market, which will really help to create the next innovation. And then you move back into the cycle again, where the new innovation comes and drives prices down again, that even further increases supply. And that has been the cycle that we have had for over 200 years in terms of really the development of commodity markets and the development of our economies, that our economy is predicated on greater energy intensity per capita, and the challenge is to ensure that that energy is cheap. We have left a very, very expensive energy environment. We are entering a very, very cheap energy environment. Of course, that could take 20 years to run its course. At which point we will move back into a high energy environment, which will drive further innovation in in developing and delivering even cheaper energy. But these are long-term cycles. The important point, of course, is that we are ending one and beginning another, and that low energy prices are one of the primary drivers of economic growth and productivity growth. For the global economy, of course, it's terrible news for the economies that are totally dependent on energy, on oil production, and it is wonderful news for everybody else. Now, I talked about that it was in the sectors where there is necessary spending. And this is something that I find incredibly interesting. It is that the cost of developing new drugs in the healthcare sector is on an exponential growth trajectory. It is costing a fortune to bring new drugs to market. And this was the most recent chart I could find, which demonstrates that exponential growth curve. And I have seen additional articles that between 2010 and 2014, that the price of developing drugs has gone from 1.5 billion to 2.5 billion. So it isn't getting cheaper, it is just getting more expensive. And that represents massive challenges for the pharmaceutical sector because they can't simply bet on small drugs. They have to bet on blockbusters. They have to bet on drugs that can be sold to large numbers of people. And that's problematic because then what happens if the drug that you provide doesn't work? The risks are very high. The cost of making bets in the sector is incredibly high. And that is part of the reason that they have largely outsourced research and development to the biotechnology sector. That you have a steady pace of mergers and acquisitions within the biotech sector as established pharmaceutical companies try to buy them before they get too big. What it also means is that in order to raise cash, what we have seen in the pharmaceutical sector is that they have a process of raising prices steadily for legacy drugs. They have done the work, they have created the product, and the market for it might be declining, but the revenue keeps going up because they keep raising the prices. And what was, particularly interesting is when Mrs. Tracy had to get an MRI a couple of weeks ago for the which turned out to be a burst disc on her back. We phoned around the various testing locations, and depending on whether you're willing to pay cash or use insurance, there was a $2,000 difference in pricing in a really quite a small area, and between various different providers. And that is also a further testament to the fact that there doesn't seem to be any realization within the sector that paying $2,000 for testing is a ridiculous sum. What we are seeing is pushback. That there is not only is there pushback from consumers, but there is increasing competition because there is a lot of fat in a market which charges $2,000 for a test, or $2,000 or $1,900 for an item that has been in production for 20 years and has had no change whatsoever. And it really is the antithesis of what you see in the consumer electronics sector, where there is massive competition. And that is going to change because with that kind of competition for these broad spectrum drugs, they are completely ignoring the growth in the delivery of personalized medicine and one-hit medicine. Large numbers of drugs are sold to treat chronic conditions, but what happens if you could change someone's genetic identity so that the chronic condition just goes away, that you would only have to treat them once, rather than spending huge quantities of money on treating chronic conditions? You could spend money once and fix them. And that is the promise of personalized medicine. And personalized medicine has been a rather airy-fairy topic for really quite a long time, and it has been the panacea of what people have been looking for. But it is nearing commercialization because we are seeing the confluence of a number of different technologies really being targeted at this sector. And among those are the it is an enormous innovation in artificial intelligence, and each one of us and the extraordinary diversity within our biomes and within our genetic identities will require exabytes of data, and that is for every single one of us. And the ability to parse that data is now possible because the computing power has become so much more impressive and cheaper. With more and more people having their genes sequenced, and not just superficial sequencing but deep sequencing, and with increasing numbers of people having their microbiome deep sequenced, that is creating masses of data. And in addition to that, the innovation that is CRISPR, and the fact that it went global in the space of about 6 months and is now pretty much ubiquitous within the sector, that means that we also get targeted editing. So we get masses of additional data, we get massive computing, and then we get the ability to write strings falling from $2 a base pair to 3 cents a base pair within the last 6 years. So that makes even the exponential pace at which the cost of solar cells declining look slow. The cost of sequencing genes and writing base pairs, which is two very different things indeed, is also declining at an incredibly fast pace. And that represents incredibly good news for consumers. It is something that has the potential to absolutely revolutionize the healthcare sector in within the decade. It is terrible news for pharmaceutical companies because it is not a broad spectrum solution. It isn't that you spend $2.5 billion to come up with something and then sell it to large numbers of people. This is something different. It is you come up with a tailored solution to every individual and automate it. That is something that can be sold, but it is something that has to be done for every individual person. It's a completely different business model. And when we look at the S&P 500 healthcare sector, this is no longer a trend that is consistent. We had an incredibly persistent and consistent advance between 2011 and the middle of 2015. And now we have moved into this volatile, ranging environment. It is an example of ranging time and size. This is a much bigger range than any of the consolidations that we saw in the last 7 years. It is going on for much longer than any other range. And it is so you've got ranging, you've got time, and you've got size, because it has been going sideways now for a year and a half. And a sustained move to new highs will be required to confirm that this isn't anything other than a consolidation, because right now it looks like a developing top formation. And we can logically see why that might be the case. The fact that a lot of these companies have got a lot of cash, that they pay impressive dividends, has probably helped to support this market over the last year. But if we start getting higher interest rates and you don't get a commensurate move higher in earnings, then those dividends become less competitive. And this is potentially a sector that could be in real trouble. What I find particularly interesting is that in the biotech sector, we have had profound diversity in performance. That the best performing share this year was up 334%, and the worst performer was down 93%. What it continues to tell us is that there are clear winners and losers. There is going to be a, and something that has certainly been a theme this year, and I think it'll likely still be a theme next year, has been the immuno-oncology drugs that are coming through. That and these are, I think, the first round of companies that are benefiting from revolutions in genetic engineering, that they are targeting the genetics of cancer cells. They are helping to educate the immune system so that the immune system will fight the cancer. And that means there's no chemo. And that is something that is really quite profound, but it is something that is in its very early stages. And again, it represents a rather different business model. So these are two huge sectors, and when we think about how much money do consumers spend on healthcare, and obviously in the US, people are very personally knowledgeable of how much they spend because they're fronting their health insurance premiums, and those health insurance premiums are really beyond belief to much of the rest of the world. At the same time, the cost of healthcare is largely hidden in the rest of the world because it's wrapped into taxes, and the amount of tax that people pay in Europe is rather startling to people in the USA. People don't understand in the US, they don't understand that people in the UK and Europe pay much higher taxes on their payroll, and then they pay much higher sales tax in addition to that. I've run the numbers, and even with the much higher health insurance premiums that you pay in the USA, you still end up paying less than you would if you were working in pretty much any other part of Europe, because of the way the tax system is structured. In the US, that is. So I think that we can look on health, the revolution in healthcare, as potentially removing a massive roadblock in terms of economic potential. If the cost of healthcare, and not least treating either incredibly expensive and life-threatening diseases like cancer, or treating chronic conditions like diabetes or arthritis, if those types of problems can be solved, that removes a massive headwind in terms of both personal and government spending. If we get energy prices that where energy goes into a lengthy period where it is not a headwind to economic potential, then that also can boost productivity. And I think that these are two of the most important sectors. And the fact is, of course, that these solutions are going global instantly, that solar cells are not simply available in the Western world, they're available everywhere. That this the potential for revolutions to occur in, and I think it is much more appropriate to talk about what is happening in healthcare as a paradigm shift, is that has the potential to also go global quickly because of the amount of money that it could save governments. And governments really do need to save money because they're broke. And if we are going to have a bull market that is driven by productivity growth and economic growth, then that is, in fact, the only potential scenario that is going to allow governments to pay back their debts. And of course, if we are going to have that kind of growth, then interest rates will rise, borrowing costs will increase, and we will have to have some kind of rationalization of the kind of debt that has been built up, and the pension liabilities that are outstanding really do need to be tackled. That they're either going to have to be tackled by a reduction in benefits, or the cost of delivering those benefits will have to come down. And of course, the the cost of delivering those benefits coming down is, of course, much more politically palatable than trying to remove them entirely. So there is a massive incentive to drive a paradigm shift in healthcare provision. When we look at the government bond markets and we look at them over the very long term, then we know that we have been in a very, very long-term process of lower yields. And it is looking increasingly likely that that is over. And we can see very clearly over the last 4 years that the decline has lost momentum. Of course, this isn't the first time that the decline has lost momentum. And we have certainly seen a big pickup in yields over the last 2 months, and some of that is being unwound right now. If we look at just the weekly chart, it is very easy to make an argument that we have had a very big move already, and that the likelihood is that now we're going to get some consolidation. And now that we have seen at least near-term resistance in yields, support in prices, at around the 2.5% level, that we get some pause in consolidation. I continue to believe that that this is the most important chart overall, and it is the total return on a future strategy, that if you were buying futures and rolling them over at their expiry, how would you have done? And this is quite clearly the biggest reaction we've seen ever. And that ever is a very long time. This chart goes back to 1983. And this is the biggest pullback we've ever seen. You can't simply write that off as an anomaly. And most particularly, you won't write that off as an anomaly when the market has been going up for 23 years. So, is it oversold in the short term? And I think we can all answer yes, of course it is. There is ample potential for a bounce in the short term. But then the question is, do we encounter resistance in the region of the trend mean, or the upper side of the overhead range, sorry, the lower side of the overhead range? If that is in fact the case, and we then break below 2000, we'll have a confirmed top. That could happen in 2017. That is something that we have to absolutely be prepared for, that the secular bull market in bonds is over, that we are going to have we're going to have higher borrowing costs, that the only way that we're going to see economic growth continue is if the energy prices come down and the delivery of healthcare gets cheaper. And it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. When we look at where the yield curve is, that it is still very wide. In fact, it is widening. So we do not have any flashing warning lights that we are entering a bear market anytime soon. We do know that a great deal of debt needs to be refinanced between 2018 and 2020, that a lot of the debt that was taken out in 2008 had 10-year maturities. So that is going to represent a challenge for the fixed income markets, because a lot of that debt was originally taken out at extraordinarily low yields and is going to have to be refinanced at higher yields. So, and we also know that it is quite rare that high yield debt is paid back. It's most often refinanced, or it is redeemed. So, or redeemed because of a takeover. So that is a potential headache. When we look at the benign scenario overall, then we also have to, of course, be cognizant that there are threats. And the S&P 500 has broken up out of a lengthy range. It is overbought in the short term, and it does look like we are going to get some consolidation, at least of that big move on the upside. It has been led higher by the banking sector, and the banking sector, having done so spectacularly well, has largely paused over the last few weeks, that it is somewhat overbought in the short term. But that is exactly what we expect to happen when you get a bullish catalyst coming through. We had a period of synchronized global economic expansion until about 2007. We have gone through a period of global monetary expansion, and there is the increasing potential that we could be moving into a period of global fiscal expansion, and that is being led by the US. And what we also know, and I think that it is something that we are going to see debated, is if we do start getting higher interest rates, what we have seen, and I think the euro dollar is a great example of it, that just over the last 2 months we have seen major spikes. These are huge tails on the candles, and euro dollar is the biggest, most liquid currency pair. It isn't something that you can simply move around on a whim, and yet we have seen these massive moves, and they're driven by algorithmic trading systems, and algorithmic trading systems have proliferated because the cost of running these massive computers has collapsed. That has certainly enabled a lot of the arbitrages in the market and the predatory systems that exist today. But in addition to that, they have proliferated because we have extraordinarily low interest rates, that leverage and hedging cost nothing. And that's not always going to be the case, that the massive supply of monetary stimulus will not always be in place. The incredibly low cost of borrowing will not always be the case. So we are in, perhaps, for at least the traders involved, we're in the golden age of algorithmic trading. When interest rates go back up, that kind of trading is going to be much more difficult. Right now, we have seen, and just today, we've seen another example of it. Obviously, this is in the quiet period between Christmas and New Year. So if you're going to try and affect a big liquid market, this would have been the day in which to do it. Every time the euro has rallied over the last 2 months and failed, it has moved to a new low. We have not seen the intraday reversal that we saw on the two previous occasions, but we have certainly seen the euro give up all of its advance today. I think the 105 area is still an area where there is a lot of questions being asked. When we talk about governance, we are seeing that governance is improving in Asia. It is most particularly improving in Indonesia, and I think to some extent in Vietnam, but most particularly in India. The demonetization that has rather ham-fistedly been introduced in India represents a risk. But if it can succeed in reducing the role of the black market in that country, it would be incredibly beneficial over the medium term. But unfortunately, in Europe, we have a dearth of improving standards of governance, that the European Commission is in large part autocratic, that there is clear evidence that there is one set of rules for large countries and quite another for small countries, that the bureaucracy will do whatever it takes to ensure that they remain in their very privileged positions. And that is part of the reason that the euro should continue to decline. But of course, if the fact that they will do whatever it takes to ensure the currency survives removes a certain amount of risk from the stock market. And this has been a substantial breakout from a lengthy trading range from the Euro Stoxx index. It has also broken the medium-term progression of lower rally highs. And when we look at this market, over not just the last 5 years, but over the last 20 years, we're only about halfway through the a rally towards the upper side of what has been a 26-year range so far. When it eventually gets to 450, then there'll be big questions asked. The FTSE 100, which has been flattered by the devaluation of the currency, has also been ranging for a long time and is on the cusp of breaking higher. It is trading above 7,000, and 7,000 has been an area of resistance for 16 years, not 26 years, 16 years. This continues to look like a market that is primed for a break on the upside. It is dominated by energy companies and banks, and then there are a substantial number of consumer-oriented global companies as well. If the FTSE 100 is breaking upwards, and it is doing it without the benefit of the pound going down in a swift manner, then we can conclude that it is a good indication that global economic growth is not that bad, that it hasn't really been doing much of anything for a long time, and that these very lengthy ranges give way to big bull markets. So there is a lot of doubt still being expressed. There is a lot of anxiousness being expressed about the fortunes of the UK, and yet the stock market would tell us that there is reason for optimism. When we look at the emerging markets index, and I don't generally look at it, but I think it does give us an indication of how the big markets are doing, because it is heavily weighted by the BRIC countries, which is mostly China, India, and Russia, and not so much Brazil anymore. It does not represent a consistent pattern, but it has been flattered for the last year by the move in commodity prices. The continuous commodity index is coming off of very, very depressed levels and continues to bounce from the region of the 200-day moving average. Over the last 3 days, I've looked at overextensions relative to the trend mean for the FTSE 350, the S&P 500, and the ASX 300. And what has come out very clearly is that there have been very impressive rallies from very, very depressed levels this year in the commodity complex. And when we can see that with the continuous commodity index, that it trended from 700 to 350 over the space of 5 years, and it has now broken that downtrend. And as long as it is trading above the 200-day moving average, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. There is the world of difference between something like Nvidia, which trended higher for a couple of years and then accelerated higher, and now increasingly looks like it has gone high enough. And that is not the same as a number of those commodity companies which have been in incredibly depressed situations, and we have now really only seen the first doubling, that they have just moved from very depressed to reasonable valuations, and that if we do get economic growth coming through, then they will do better. I personally think that the risk of a pullback and a consolidation in the first week of January cannot be discounted, and in fact, I think that we cannot be surprised if that occurs. But just like we saw in other years, that a swift 2 week pullback at the beginning of the year was set traders up for a really attractive buying opportunity. The inauguration of President Trump on January 20th then that could act as a catalyst either to send prices lower or to act as a catalyst for the end of any kind of pullback that occurs on the first day of trading. And I think with that, I would wish a happy new year and a prosperous 2017 to all of you, and I look forward to interacting with all of you either through the service or at the chart seminar in 2017.